then we would reject the hypothesis that she was guessing. In the jargon of significance testing, we would say the significance level of our rejection is 3%, meaning that the chances are, at most 3%, that by chance the data has led us astray. A 3% level of significance is fairly impressive, and so the media might report that feat as new evidence of the existence of psychic powers. Still, those of us who don't believe in psychic powers might remain skeptical. This example illustrates an important point. Even with data significant at, say, the 3% level, if you test 100 non-psychic people for psychic abilities, or 100 ineffective drugs for their effectiveness, you ought to expect a few people to show up as psychic, or a few ineffective drugs to show up as effective. That's one reason political polls or medical studies, especially small ones, sometimes contradict earlier polls or studies. Still, significance testing and other statistical methods serve scientists well, especially when they can conduct large-scale controlled studies. But in everyday life, we don't conduct such studies, nor do we intuitively apply statistical analysis. Instead, we rely on gut instinct. When my Viking stove turned out to be a lemon, and by chance an acquaintance told me she had the same experience, I started telling my friends to avoid the brand. When the flight attendants on several United Airlines flights seemed grumpier than those on other airlines I'd recently flown with, I started avoiding United's flights. Not a lot of data there, but my gut instinct identified patterns. Sometimes those patterns are meaningful. Sometimes they are not. In either case, the fact that our perception of the patterns of life is both highly convincing and highly subjective has profound implications. It implies a kind of relativity, a situation in which, as Faraday found, reality is in the eye of the beholder. For example, in 2006, the New England Journal of Medicine published a $12.5 million study of patients with documented osteoarthritis of the knee. The study showed that a combination of the nutritional supplements, glucosamine and chondroitin, is no more effective in relieving arthritis pain than a placebo. Still, one eminent doctor had a hard time letting go of his feeling that the supplements were effective, and ended his analysis of the study on a national radio program by reaffirming the possible benefit of the treatment, remarking that, "One of my wife's doctors has a cat, and she says this cat cannot get up in the morning without a little dose of glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate." When we look closely, we find that many of the assumptions of modern society are based, as table moving is, on shared illusions. Whereas Chapter 8 is concerned with the surprising regularities exhibited by random events, in what follows I shall approach the issue from the opposite direction and examine how events whose patterns appear to have a definite cause may actually be the product of chance. It is human nature to look for patterns and to assign them meaning when we find them. Kahneman and Tversky had analyzed many of the shortcuts we employ in assessing patterns in data and in making judgments in the face of uncertainty. They dubbed those shortcuts heuristics. In general, heuristics are useful, but just as our manner of processing optical information sometimes leads to optical illusions, so heuristics sometimes lead to systematic error. Kahneman and Tversky called such errors biases. We all use heuristics, and we all suffer from biases. But although optical illusions seldom have much relevance in our everyday world, cognitive biases play an important role in human decision-making. And so in the late 20th century, a movement sprang up to study how randomness is perceived by the human mind. Researchers concluded that people have a very poor conception of randomness. They do not recognize it when they see it, and they cannot produce it when they try. And what's worse, we routinely misjudge the role of chance in our lives and make decisions that are demonstrably misaligned with our own best interests. Imagine a sequence of events. The events might be quarterly earnings or a string of good or bad dates set up through an internet dating service. In each case, the longer the sequence, or the more sequences you look at, the greater the probability that you'll find every pattern imaginable, purely by chance. As a result, a string of good or bad quarters or dates need not have any cause at all. The point is rather starkly illustrated by the mathematician George Spencer Brown, who wrote that in a random series of 10 to the 1,700 zeros and ones, you should expect at least 10 non-overlapping subsequences of 1 million consecutive zeros. Imagine the poor fellow who bumps into one of those strings when attempting to use the random numbers for some scientific purpose. His software generates 5 zeros in a row, then 10, then 20, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 500,000. Would he be wrong to send back the program and ask for a refund? And how would a scientist react upon flipping open a newly purchased book of random digits, only to find that all the digits are zeros? Spencer Brown's point was that there is a difference between a process being random and the product of that process appearing to be random. Apple ran into that issue with the random shuffling method it initially employed in its iPod music players. True randomness sometimes produces repetition. But when users heard the same song or songs by the same artist played back to back, they believed the shuffling wasn't random. And so the company made the feature less random to make it feel more random, said Apple founder Steve Jobs. One of the earliest speculations about the perception of random patterns came from the philosopher Hans Reichenbach, who remarked in 1934 that people untrained in probability would have difficulty recognizing a random series of events. Consider the following example. If you had a printout representing the results of a sequence of 200 tosses of a coin, with X representing tails and O representing heads. It is easy to find patterns in the data, for instance, the four O's followed by four X's at the beginning and the run of six X's toward the end. According to the mathematics of randomness, such runs are to be expected in 200 random tosses. Yet they surprise most people. As a result, when instead of representing coin tosses, strings of X's and O's represent events that affect our lives, people seek meaningful explanations for the pattern. When a string of X's represents down days on the stock market, people believe the experts who explain that the market is jittery. When a string of O's represents a run of accomplishments by your favorite sports star, announcers sound convincing when they drone on about the player's streakiness. And when, as we saw earlier, the X's or O's stood for strings of failed films made by Paramount and Columbia Pictures, everyone nodded as the industry rags proclaimed just who did and who did not have a finger on the pulse of the worldwide movie audience. Academics and writers have devoted much effort to studying patterns of random success in the financial markets. There is much evidence, for instance, that the performance of stocks is random, or so close to being random that in the absence of insider information and the presence of a cost to make trades or manage your portfolio, you can't profit from any deviations from randomness. Nevertheless, Wall Street has a long tradition of guru analysts, and the average analyst's salary at the end of the 1990s was about $3 million. How do those analysts do? According to a 1995 study, the 8 to 12 most highly paid Wall Street superstars, invited by Barron's to make market recommendations at its annual roundtable, merely matched the average market return. Studies in 1987 and 1997 found that stocks recommended by the prognosticators on the television show Wall Street Week did much worse, lagging far behind the market. and in a study of 153 newsletters, a researcher at the Harvard Institute of Economic Research found no significant evidence of stock-picking ability. By chance alone, some analysts and mutual funds will always exhibit impressive patterns of success. And though many studies show that these past market successes are not good indicators of future success, that is, that the successes were largely just luck, most people feel that the recommendations of their stockbroker or the expertise of those running mutual funds are worth paying for. Many people, even intelligent investors, therefore buy funds that charge exorbitant management fees. In fact, when a group of savvy students from the Wharton Business School were given a hypothetical $10,000 and prospectuses describing four index funds, each composed in order to mirror the S&P 500, the students overwhelmingly failed to choose the funds with the lowest fees. Since paying even an extra 1% per year in fees could, over the years, diminish your retirement fund by as much as one-third or even one-half, the savvy students didn't exhibit very savvy behavior. Of course, as Spencer Brown's example illustrates, if you look long enough, you're bound to find someone who, through sheer luck, really has made startlingly successful predictions. For those who prefer real-world examples to mathematical scenarios involving 10 to the 1 million and 7th power random digits, consider the case of the columnist Leonard Coppett. In 1978, Coppett revealed a system that he claimed could determine, by the end of January every year, whether the stock market would go up or down in that calendar year. His system had correctly predicted the market, he said, for the past 11 years. Of course, stock-picking systems are easy to identify in hindsight. The true test is whether they will work in the future. Coppett's system passed that test, too. Judging the market by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it worked for 11 straight years, from 1979 through 1989. Got it wrong in 1990, and was correct again every year until 1998. But although Coppett's predictions were correct for a streak of 18 out of 19 years, I feel confident in asserting that his streak involved no skill whatsoever. Why? Because Leonard Coppett was a columnist for Sporting News, and his system was based on the results of the Super Bowl, the championship game of professional football. Whenever the team from the original National Football League won, the stock market, he predicted, would rise. Whenever the team from the original American Football League won, he predicted, the market would go down. Given that information, few people would argue that Coppett was anything but lucky. Yet had he had different credentials, and not revealed his method, he could have been hailed as the most clever analyst since Charles H. Dow. As a counterpoint to Coppett's story, consider now the story of a fellow who does have credentials, a fellow named Bill Miller. For years, Miller maintained a winning streak that, unlike Coppett's, was compared to Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak and the 74 consecutive victories by the Jeopardy quiz show champ Ken Jennings. But in at least one respect, these comparisons were not very apt. Miller's streak earned him each year more than those other gentlemen's streaks had earned them in their lifetimes. For Bill Miller was the portfolio manager of Legg Mason Value Trust Fund. And in each year of his 15-year streak, his fund beat the portfolio of equity securities that constitute the Standard & Poor's 500. For his accomplishments, Miller was heralded as the greatest money manager of the 1990s by Money Magazine, Fund Manager of the Decade by Morningstar, and one of the top 30 most influential people in investing in 2001, 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006 by Smart Money. In the 14th year of Miller's streak, one analyst was quoted on the CNN Money website as putting the odds of a 14-year streak by chance alone at 372,529-1. More on that later. Academics call the mistaken impression that a random streak is due to extraordinary performance the hot hand fallacy. Much of the work on the hot hand fallacy has been done in the context of sports because, in sports, performance is easy to define and measure. Also, the rules of the game are clear and definite. Data are plentiful and public, and situations of interest are replicated repeatedly. Not to mention that the subject gives academics a way to attend games and pretend they are working. Interest in the hot hand fallacy began around 1985, in particular with a paper by Tversky and his co-workers that was published in the journal Cognitive Psychology. In that paper, The Hot Hand in Basketball, on the Misperception of Random Sequences, Tversky and his colleagues investigated reams of basketball statistics. The players' talent varied, of course. Some made half their shots, some more, some less. Each player also had occasional hot and cold streaks. The paper's authors asked the question, how do the number and length of the streaks compare with what you would observe if the result of each shot were determined by a random process? That is, how would things have turned out if, rather than shooting baskets, the players had tossed coins, weighted to reflect their observed shooting percentages? The researchers found that despite the streaks, the floor shots of the Philadelphia 76ers, the free throws of the Boston Celtics, and the experimentally controlled floor shots of the Cornell University men's and women's varsity basketball teams exhibited no evidence of non-random behavior. In particular, one direct indicator of streakiness is the conditional probability of success, that is, making a basket, if, on the prior attempt, the player had achieved success. For a streaky player, the chance of a success on the heels of a prior success should be higher than his or her overall chance of success. But the authors found that for each player, a success following a success was just as likely as a success following a failure, that is, a missed basket. A few years after Tversky's paper appeared, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, E.M. Purcell, decided to investigate the nature of streaks in the sport of baseball. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, he found, in the words of his Harvard colleague, Stephen Jay Gould, that except for Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, nothing ever happened in baseball above and beyond the frequency predicted by coin-tossing models. Not even the 21-game losing streak experienced at the start of the 1988 season by Major League Baseball's Baltimore Orioles. Bad players and teams have longer and more frequent streaks of failure than great players and great teams, and great players and great teams have longer and more frequent streaks of success than lesser players and lesser teams. But that is because their average failure or success rate is higher. And the higher the average rate, the longer and more frequent are the streaks that randomness will produce. To understand these events, you need only to understand the tossing of coins. What about Bill Miller's streak? That a streak like Miller's could result from a random process may seem less shocking in light of a few other statistics. For instance, in 2004, Miller's fund gained just under 12%, while the average stock on the S&P gained more than 15%. It might sound like the S&P trounced Miller that year, but actually he counted 2004 in his win column. That's because the S&P 500 is not the simple average of the prices of the stocks it comprises. It is a weighted average in which stocks exert influence proportional to each company's capitalization. Miller's fund did worse than the simple average of S&P stocks, but better than the weighted average. Actually, there were more than 30 12-month periods during his streak in which he lost to the weighted average, but they weren't calendar years, and the streak was based on the intervals from January 1st to December 31st. So, the streak, in a sense, was an artificial one to start with, one that by chance was defined in a manner that worked for Miller. But how can we reconcile those revelations with those 372,529 to